listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And now I'd like to turn the call over to Julia Smith-Easley. Thank you. You may begin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. Again, I'm Julia Smith-Easley with CDC's Division of Partnerships and Strategic Alliances. The purpose of today's call with the private sector is to provide an update on the H1N1 influenza investigation and to also discuss the WHO Declaration of Pandemic Basics that was made yesterday, June 11th. We will have a recording and a transcript of this call available on CDC's H1N1 website early next week, and I'll provide details for accessing these at the end of the call today. With us on today's call are Dr. Anthony Fiore, medical epidemiologist with CDC's Influenza Division, and Lisa Coonan, senior advisor with CDC's Influenza Coordination Unit. We'll begin with an overview from Dr. Fiore about the current status of the H1N1 investigation, and then have an overview from Lisa Coonan about the pandemic phase six and what this may mean for the business community. Following the updates, we'll open the line for questions. And Tony, I'll now turn this over to you.
Well, thanks very much, and thanks for inviting me to join this call. As you mentioned, my role here is to provide just an update and some background to give some context to the discussion that will follow. You've joined the call, of course, because of the fact that we've seen human illnesses with the novel H1N1 virus of swine origin. That means it's more similar to viruses that were circulating in swine up to this time, has spread throughout the world over the past 6 weeks after the initial detection within the U.S. It actually gets more like 7 or 8 weeks at this point. So it's being transmitted in communities all over the world for the past several weeks, and that is why WHO has declared this pandemic phase six. And this declaration has more implications for other countries than it does for us. We've been operating under the assumption that we're moving to phase six for the past several weeks. It's been pretty clear. At this point, there have been almost 29,000 reported cases coming from over 70 countries, and that includes nearly 18,000 cases in the United States. It's also important, though, to recognize that there are many more than this number of cases in reality, because persons often don't get tested, either because they have a mild illness and they appropriately stay home and don't necessarily need to seek medical care, or because they're in an area where there are already many cases identified, and when they discuss with their clinician their illness, they're assumed to have this virus and they don't actually get testing. And again, that's also appropriate behavior if they're not particularly sick or they don't have underlying conditions that predispose them to be particularly sick. So these folks don't show up in the statistics, and that's why I say this 29,000 overall reported cases is probably just a proportion of the overall total cases that are out there, some of whom have not gotten diagnoses. A large proportion of cases in the U.S. have occurred in a limited number of states and cities. The highest impact states thus far have been California, Texas, Arizona, New York, Illinois, Washington, and Wisconsin. In the last week, we've heard about lots of cases in Massachusetts and Connecticut, and New England appears to be getting a lot of activity right now. And again, this activity has waxed and waned in some of these areas, and it's varied a great deal by community. There's some states that have been relatively unaffected, and this is not unusual for influenza to have this sort of sporadic pattern like this. We expect transmission to continue in the U.S. over the summer. We typically see seasonal influenza, that's different from this, outbreaks in the northern hemisphere in January or February. An outbreak can begin as early as October, which means that we might see a really odd-looking flu season this year with continued transmission of this novel H1N1 virus, and with potentially having seasonal flu viruses show up at their usual time and having circulation of a number of different influenza viruses at the same time. Or it's also possible that the seasonal flu will be dampened this year. It's also possible that this virus will fade out as the seasonal flu season begins. We just don't have enough experience to really make this prediction at this point. But we're planning, for planning assumptions, we're planning on a worst-case scenario, which is that all of the virus is circulating through the flu season. Transmission is also now occurring in the southern hemisphere, typical to see influenza virus transmission pick up at this time of year because it's their winter. We're seeing cases of both seasonal flu and this novel H1N1 being reported in countries that, including Argentina, Chile, South Africa, and Australia. And for those of you who have business partnerships in these areas, the best way to keep up to speed with this is to check the World Health Organization website on a regular basis, or even potentially check the country public health websites themselves, which hopefully will be getting updated on a regular basis. The illness that's caused by this influenza virus looks a lot like seasonal influenza, and what this means is there is a wide spectrum of ways that people present with their illness, anything from a mild, brief upper respiratory illness with some fever that might not even prompt a call to a clinician or doesn't prompt anything other than staying home for a couple of days, to moderate illness that causes a person to miss a week or more of school or work, to more severe illnesses, which can include hospitalization, intensive care unit admissions, or even death. And thus far in the U.S., we've seen 1,621 hospitalizations as of today and 45 deaths. Again, this seems like a lot when you use it as a denominator over the 17,000 cases reported. But remember, we're much better at identifying these more severe cases. People that go to a doctor and are really sick and have to go to the ICU do tend to get a diagnosis. And so the spectrum of illness, while it includes severe infections, for the most part, most people will have a relatively mild and typical influenza-like illness. It's enough to maybe knock you out for a few days, but it's something that might not necessarily require anything more than staying home and treating your symptoms. The outbreak has been unusual compared to seasonal flu in a couple of ways. One of them is that there's been higher illness rates, that the illness rates, including the severe illness rates, have been highest in young children and young adults compared to older adults. So just looking at the statistics right now, approximately 1% of the total confirmed cases have been among persons 65 and older, and persons 65 and older are about 4% of the hospitalized cases. Now, in the general population, persons 65 and older are about 13% of the general population, and that indicates that the deaths and hospitalizations in this age group are disproportionately low. And the reason that's important is that that's really different from seasonal flu, because for seasonal flu, we estimate that over 60% of hospitalizations, over 90% of deaths, find persons 65 or older. And so there's this striking contrast with this new virus that it's hitting persons in younger age groups, and that, of course, would include much of the workforce, as well as their children, when they might have to stay home either for their own infections or for their children's illnesses. Certain medical conditions, just like with seasonal flu, and including pregnancy, are recognized as increasing the risk of complications. Among persons that have been hospitalized thus far that we have enough information to look at, 71% of them have one or more high-risk conditions, which include things like heart conditions, lung conditions, but also include things like pregnancy. In fact, 7% of those hospitalized persons were pregnant. However, we have seen and we're going to continue to see healthy persons that have severe illness. It's not going to be that common, but it's important to recognize that you don't have to have an underlying condition to get severe illness. So let me just say a few words about the development of a vaccine against this novel influenza H1N1. As you know, a couple of weeks ago, Secretary Sebelius announced that nearly $1 billion was going towards vaccine development and manufacturing, and that's on top of a considerable investment that's been made in the past couple of years to increase our capacity to rapidly make an influenza vaccine, anticipating a pandemic such as this. We know, however, that even with our best case scenario, that the vaccine takes 20 to 25 weeks at least to go from the point of having a seed strain to the point of having a vaccine that can be distributed to people. And that's because you have to find a good virus that's a good candidate for making a vaccine. You have to alter the virus in such a way that it can be grown in bulk. You have to see how well it stimulates an immune response in both animal studies and in people. You have to look for signs of safety issues in those early studies. And you have to figure out a way to scale up to a manufacturing process that includes rigorous quality control and can also make hundreds of millions of doses. It's quite a challenge. The money that's been provided most recently is going to go towards things like clinical trials that will be carried out through the National Institutes of Health and in collaboration with the manufacturers and with guidance from the Food and Drug Administration and from BARDA, which is a part of HHS called the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Agency that works on pandemic influenza matters. There are five different manufacturers that HHS has contracted with, and there's at this point procurement orders both for the vaccine antigen, that is the part of the vaccine that stimulates the immune response, as well as an additive called an adjuvant, which can boost the immune response further. It's not certain if we'll be using that adjuvant, but again, the planning assumptions are such that we want to look at worst-case scenarios, and I want to look at how to make the most amount of vaccine go the furthest. So in summary, for the vaccine, we need to be able to manufacture a vaccine in case there's a decision to use it. We need to have it on hand. We've not yet made that decision on whether to use the vaccine. That's going to depend on the scientific data that comes in over the next few weeks and months, and those decisions will be made at a federal level, whether to recommend it, as many other countries will make those same sorts of decisions. But having these orders in place and starting route right now gives us the flexibility to be able to start a vaccine campaign if it's necessary to keep our options open. So I'll finish up with just a few words about vaccination in the fall. I mentioned that we don't know what's going to happen with seasonal influenza virus, nor with this new novel H1N virus. We don't know if the new virus will crowd out the usual flu viruses, whether there's going to be many flu viruses circulating, whether we'll continue to have this same degree of transmission that we're seeing right now right through the summer, or whether it's going to fade off in the hot weather like seasonal flu viruses typically do. So we're preparing what we think is most likely, again, sort of the worst-case scenario, which is that we're going to need to have a typical seasonal influenza vaccine campaign, just like always. And in addition, perhaps later in the fall, we'll have to roll out a novel influenza H1N1 vaccine campaign. Now, if that novel H1N1 vaccine becomes available, it's probably not going to start becoming available until October or later. It's also probably going to be given in a different way. It's not going to just be added to the seasonal vaccine. It's probably going to need to be a single antigen vaccine. That means it will only have that one component of the novel influenza virus in it. It's going to begin as a federal program. It'll probably be administered in a somewhat different way and won't necessarily, at least in the early stages, go through the typical commercial distribution channels that seasonal flu vaccine does. But all of that is still in the process of being decided at this point. So businesses that are looking at what they need to do as they approach the fall, knowing that vaccine, when it becomes available, might be in short supply and won't become available potentially until there's a lot more transmission of this novel H1N1, are going to have to fall back on the usual basic measures to prevent flu, and that is having sick people stay home until they're well, letting their kids stay home from school so that we don't have accelerated transmission in school, avoiding contact with others, basic things like covering coughs and washing hands are surprisingly important. They're basic, but they're still important. And finally, thinking about for persons, especially for your workforce, who are at higher risk for complications, those who are pregnant or who have chronic medical conditions, that they seek medical care if they develop what seems like influenza. The people with severe respiratory infection that comes on suddenly, even if they're already healthy, seek medical care because there are antiviral medications available. These medications are quite effective, including against this novel influenza H1N1 virus. They can shorten the duration of illness. They can reduce the severity of the symptoms, but they need to be given early if they're going to be effective. I think I would end this background discussion with encouraging everyone to be quite flexible this year, that things are going to change potentially rapidly, that guidance, various types of guidance might change as we learn more about the science, as we have vaccine become available. We'll need to keep testing for all kinds of different things, including whether the virus is changing, whether there's antiviral susceptibility issues. But at this point, the best message I can tell folks is to just keep abreast of what's going on. I think the CDC.gov website is a great resource for this. The WHO website for international issues is another great resource. And be prepared for change. It certainly will be changing over the course of the next few months, and probably right through the regular seasonal influenza season. So we're looking at the next 8 months being a pretty exciting time as far as flu goes.
Thank you, Dr. Fiore. The excellent background comments. Let me start by talking about the latest announcement that the World Health Organization gave to us yesterday, which was raising the worldwide pandemic alert level to phase 6. Designation of this phase means that there's been widespread global spread of this H1N1 virus, and there is now community-level outbreaks not only in North America, South America, but most places around the world. What's really important here is to understand that this designation of a phase 6 is not an indicator of severity. That doesn't mean that things got worse. What it means is that the virus has now sustained transmission between person to person in many, many, many places around the world. And that's a very important thing for you to know because it has direct relevance to your planning. WHO's decision to raise this pandemic alert level to phase 6 is to assist countries, to assist governments and private sector and citizens to be prepared and to act appropriately for this infectious disease. And for the CDC, there's no recommendations that we are changing right now for individuals, for states, and for communities because we are recommending guidance based on the extent of illness that we see here and the severity that we are seeing here. And as you know, we've been preparing for some time for this, and many of you have been preparing as well. We are actively and aggressively implementing our pandemic response plan, and we know that at the onset of this disease, when we first noted it in the spring, it was quite disorienting. We were not prepared for an H1N1 pandemic. We were certainly focusing a good bit of our attention on the H5N1 virus and the spread that was ongoing in Asia and the Middle East. And I think a lot of us, including businesses, may have been a little caught off guard by this. So here's what I want to say to you. And first of all, there are two words that I want you to remember. One is uncertainty. And because there's uncertainty on how severe or serious this novel H1N1 virus will be in terms of how it will come back in the fall to the U.S. and to the Northern Hemisphere, we have to be, as Dr. Fiore said, flexible. We have to make sure that in our planning, we not only plan for a severe situation, but we also plan for a moderate situation. One of the new things that WHO has announced is a new 3-point severity scale of mild, moderate, and severe. And at this time, WHO has indicated that the H1N1 outbreak seems to be moderate or moderately severe. And that severity index is a guide for countries and communities on how to act. However, the second word I want you to remember is a long one, but it's heterogeneity. And what that means is that we really saw a different picture depending on where we look. In the United States, some communities were hardly touched by the disease at all, where other communities were had explosive outbreaks. And the same around the world. Some countries are being hit right now, and adjacent countries are not having a large amount of disease. As we see this new virus adapt to humans, it's not unusual that we see such erratic behavior. But what this means is that what we need to do to protect our population and protect the health of people really has to depend on what we're seeing on the ground level. And the transmission varies from person to person, varies from country to country, largely because of a whole host of factors. Like I said, the virus is new, it's still adapting to human to human. The impact may also be related to the healthcare capacity in that country, the timing that people seek medical care, their health status or nutritional status, and effectiveness of efforts to reduce transmission. So we're going to see more and continued heterogeneity or different pictures all over the world. But as we study this intensively over time, we will become more familiar with it. We will learn more. And as Dr. Fiore said, our guidance will likely change. One of the things that we have learned during this outbreak is we need to be nimble. We need to be able to assess what's going on and tailor our response based on that picture. And that is what businesses need to do as well. So let me talk about the implications for businesses and what this might mean for your planning. first of all, you should be very tied in to local and state as well as federal recommendations and re-examine your business plans based on where you have a footprint and what's going on in that local area. If you have operations in other countries, you definitely need accurate and timely information about what's going on with local conditions and what the public health recommendations are and actions that are being taken in those areas. And setting up feeds of information now is going to be important now and also critical for the fall. Now, many of you have already done your planning that were linked to assumptions of severity, and those assumptions may exceed the current scenario. Therefore, it's really important to take time, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, while we have a continuing disease but not quite explosive disease as other places, to really look at your plan, to think about how you would implement those plans if we see a reemergence of disease that's similar to what we've experienced in the spring, or something that might be more severe. You should, again, make sure that you know about reliable sources of local information. And what we are going to understand more and more about this disease is how it affects people. But one thing we do know, and that is because it's a new virus, most people will have no immunity. And our number one control strategy in that situation is keeping sick people and well people apart. And therefore, as Dr. Fiore said, it's very, very important that employers encourage sick workers to stay home and away from the workplace. This is something that CDC has been discussing with businesses for a good bit of time, and it becomes even more important now that we have a real outbreak going on with the real possibility of its return in the fall. Leave policies for this outbreak need to be formulated now, because it takes time to get those leave policies approved if there's not already a standard sick leave policy for all employees. Those leave policies need to consider sick employees that may just need to stay out for 7 or up to 10 days, perhaps, if they're sick, and also leave policies that provide the allowance for people to stay home and care for sick family members or parents who may need to care for small children if schools are dismissed in the fall if we see a particularly severe outbreak. Now, also, not only protecting the workforce is a key consideration, but also planning for business continuity. It's very important to identify essential business functions. It's important to identify those job positions in businesses that are so critical to the operations of the business that there needs to be redundancy or protection of those employees. And there needs to be an assessment of supply chain and other critical inputs to see about making alternative plans in case they may be disrupted. Now, it's very important that employers understand that planning now is really going to be important. It is not going to be possible to pivot on the fly if we are hit with a severe outbreak in the fall. So I encourage you to spend the time that we have now looking at your HR policies, looking at your workplace flexibilities, looking at pay and benefit structure, and perhaps going ahead and telling employees that you are planning for a possible fall outbreak. You may not choose to give the details of those plans right now, but if you do explain to your employees that you're planning, perhaps they will understand what better to do come fall. Now, many employers have developed those plans. If you've not begun those plans, we would encourage you to start planning now. On www.pandemicflu.gov, we have a number of tools and guidance pieces that have been developed to assist employers in planning. This novel H1N1 pandemic, whether it is mild, moderate, or severe, really affects us all. And this is a situation of shared responsibility. And that is, it will take the efforts not only from government to make sure that we survive intact as a country, as communities through a particularly severe outbreak, but we also need other sectors to participate in this effort, including healthcare and businesses in the private sector. We must really tackle this together, and we must be informed about the recommendations that are needed and try to align our business practices with those public health recommendations to get the best output possible. So let me stop here, Julia, and Dr. Fiore and I are here, and we can take questions, operator.
Operator, could you let people know how to ask their questions, and then we'll turn it over to the first question. Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one on your touch-tone phone. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Again, to ask a question, please press star one and record your name. Our first question comes from Dr. Will Sawyer, Clean Hands Coalition. Sir, your line is open.
Hi, I'm Dr. Will Sawyer. I'm a practicing family physician as well, and there's a coalition that's been created to promote clean hands, safe lives. And so CDC and Prevention's done a great job of evaluating and following and tracking, and you're asking us all to implement a plan as an employer in the future, but you're not really giving us the tools that are absolutely critical. So what I would ask people is, the American Medical Association had endorsed the four principles of hand awareness, which you can Google and figure out. There's this, the Clean Hands Coalition talks about as well, clean hands save lives, as well, because it, for employers, it's critical to give your employees specifics on what to use. So I would then ask the CDC, Lisa particularly, when are we as the CDC going to promote that? And the fourth principle is do not touch your eyes, nose, and mouth, because they really don't talk about that yet, just hand washing and covering a cough.
Well, thank you, Dr. Story, for your comments. On the contrary, we actually have been heavily promoting hand washing, covering your cough etiquette, and not touching your nose, eyes, or mouth. And in fact, on our website, in many, many places, we have posted flyers and posters that employers can download about covering your cough, the clean hands save lives, posters, slides, and buttons. We have podcasts about this, and we're disseminating this pretty broadly. In fact, I would encourage you to look on www.cdc.gov on our H1N1 flu site, and there is a specific page for businesses that has a listing of resources and tools.
Yep.
Thank you for your comment.
Operator, could we have the next question, please? Thank you. Our next question comes from Tom Spock, Rickett and Bankheiser. Your line is open.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to thank you both at the CDC. The job you're doing in covering this is just outstanding. My question is, in your studies of this particular virus strain, have you learned anything new regarding why